I'm JP Robinson, and this is Heroes and Villains.
Our young men today are left so much without a moral compass. They're kind of are forgotten right now.
I'm so glad to welcome you here today to Heroes and Villains. Today, we are so excited to have with us Vincent B. Davis II. He is an author, entrepreneur, and soldier. This is JP Robinson. And again, today, we're so excited to have you on this episode of Heroes and Villains. A little bit about our guest speaker today. Vincent is a graduate of East Tennessee State University. He has served in the U.S. Army since 2014. He's the author of 5 books, 2 of which have become international bestsellers. When he's not researching or writing his next book, you can find him watching Carolina Panthers football or playing with his rescued mutton buddies. So, Vincent, we're really glad to have you here today. And we're just having a freelance conversation here, an authentic conversation about writing Heroes and Villains. But I'm going to turn it over to Vincent right now and ask you, can you tell us, Vincent, about yourself, your work, what got you into this? Let's open up the conversation.
Yeah. All right. So I got into the industry back in 2017 was when I officially first stepped in. But really, I got my start, I guess you could say, when I was, I don't know if you, I really can put a date on it. I'd always wanted to be an author. I still have pictures of me running around with a Jar Jar Binks notebook when I was about 5 years old, filled with Star Wars fan fiction. Right. So I think I'd always wanted to tell stories. And so I kind of let the real world beat that out of me a little bit. You know, I was told you can't make a living telling, you know, writing books, and, you know, you've got to get a real job. And so for a long time, you know, my plan was to go into business and have a more structured life, you know, so to speak. And then I thought, you know, maybe I'll write when I'm older, maybe I'll write when I'm retired, you know. Something just kind of struck me as I was in college, and I thought, you know, as I was about to graduate and I was about to get settled in with my full-time career and, you know, go down that path of life, I kind of thought about it, and I thought, you know, I don't have a wife, children, a mortgage at that time. You know, if I'm going to take a risk, right now is the time to do it. So I quit my job at the time, which was pretty risky looking back on it. I was in the Army Reserves, had a couple $100 a month coming in from that. I took out a loan to fund my first project, and I just went all in. And fortunately, God opened up a lot of doors, which allowed that to prosper, at least in, you know, that's a relative term, I guess. But for me, it's allowed me to stay in the industry. And so, the first book was followed up by many. I need to update that bio. Clearly, I'm at 8 books now. I'm at 8 books now, so still on the move, hoping for more in the near future. So, so that's how I got in the industry, and that's how it's been excellent. And then since then, because I was able to manage some form of success with my books without a platform, without social media presence, without all those things that you're supposed to have, you know, as an author, you know, some folks started to kind of notice that I was doing all of these things within Amazon itself. So I started, you know, being hired to help other authors, and lo and behold, just, you know, over time, I work full time in the industry as well with publishers and authors to help them expand their presence on Amazon and just sell more books in general.
And that is, first of all, that's a tremendous success story, and one that is not always all that common. So it's really great to hear you take that approach, especially as we're seeing such a huge push towards in the indie publishing line of things, and our view of what makes successful publishing is morphing. You know, it's changing so much. So I think even before we get into the specifics about, you know, writing characters and character developments and things like that, I think maybe now would be a great time just to stop for a minute and say, what would be 2 things that you would tell any indie author that would be key or critical towards their own success, or could fuel their own success?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think honestly that the advice that I would have would probably be even the same for someone who is seeking to traditionally publish, because that the lines have been blurred so much, you know, as the industry has been changing, that so many of the things that were required to have success in indie publishing, you really need it on the traditional side too. But, you know, I think that the first and foremost thing would be, you know, I meet and work with so many authors. And the number one thing that I think determines whether someone will have a level of success in the industry versus those that won't or don't, at least yet, it really does come down to perseverance. And I know how, you know, trite that may sound, or cliche. But at the end of the day, that really has been my experience. If someone is willing to continue to try, because and you and I have actually spoken about this before, a book can have a million lifetimes. It's not like, you know, in days past where you did a print run of 1,000 books and it went out to all kinds of bookstores. And if it didn't sell well, then it was, you know, your time was done. Bookstores weren't going to, stock you again. They were going to send back your books. And the book was kind of going to be written off. You know, now, if I have a book published and it's out there and I'm not doing what I would like to do in terms of sales, there's so many elements that I can continue to work on and change. As long as I'm willing to go back to the drawing board and make those changes, there's always an opportunity for success. So that would be number one. And number two would be to not focus on the sales themselves, but rather the elements that make up sales, which are within our control. Because of course we can't actually control sales, which sometimes people are like, you know, you're the marketing guy, what do you mean you can't control sales? But, you know, unless we can control people's, you know, consumer behavior and make them click the buy now button, we can't control them directly. But sales are made up of two elements. I call this my magic formula. So it's not magic, but it's magic in managing blood pressure, because trying to focus on the sales can be quite stressful. So it's traffic plus conversion equals sales. So when I'm having a lack of sales or perceived lack of sales, I'm not doing what I think I should be doing or what I would like to be doing. I'm going to break it down a little bit. Okay. So traffic, you know, how am I getting people to the book page currently? You know, what am I doing to get the book in front of people? Is it visible enough? Is it possible for it to be discovered at a high level? And if it's not, then that's where I'll start. I'll run more advertisements. I'll drop the price down. I will, maybe put something on social media or do a newsletter swap with another author, whatever it is. I'll get more people to the book page. But if I'm doing that, you know, well, and I'm not getting the sales to come from it, then it's not that I just need to run more ads. And that's what I see a lot. You know, when I see authors that they're not seeing the level of sales that they'd like, so they just throw more at the wall. They spend more money on promotions and things like that. And that's not the worst thing in the world to do, but, it doesn't always fix the problem. If people are coming to the book page and they're not buying, then it's the conversion elements that need to be addressed. So your cover design, your title, your description, what's your price like? You know, how competitive is it with the market? How many reviews do you have, right? And maybe you don't have enough reviews to be able to convince a significant portion of the buying market, those who don't know you or the title. They're just looking for their next book to convince them the book is worth their time and their investment. Right. So by those two things, I think are really the primary indicators of success. If you have that level of perseverance where you say, you know, I'm in this for the long haul, it might not be easy out of the gate, but we'll continue to work on it until we get this thing moving. And then you focus on those two elements I really think that that a lot of folks can have success in this industry. I really do. There's never been a time in the history, not only of publishing, but of storytelling, which that's been going on a while. There's never been a time, I think, in history that is it's better, a better opportunity for folks to make a living telling stories.
For those of you listening, jumping in now, this is Vincent B. Davis II here. His website is Vincent B. Davis II, for the second, of course, .com. Vincent is an entrepreneur, author, and he's two of his books have become international bestsellers. And as he was just sharing with us over here, we were discussing here the importance of and the ability for indie authors at this time to make such a huge impact in our world through sales. And so, Vincent, thank you so much for those comments. Those are really helpful. And right now, what we're going to do is we're going to switch directions here and start focusing more about what we're here to talk about, really, here on Heroes and Villains, which is Heroes and Villains. Vincent focuses his writing primarily on ancient Rome, and his brand is, you know, if you visit his website, you're going to see some really incredible footage, a great presentation, and you're going to see consistently we have this feel of ancient Rome, which means, Vincent, you are a hero to my youngest son. Okay, he's he's a little young to read your books yet, but you know, anything involving Rome is his, you know, anyone in writing about Rome is like you know, way up there.
Right.
I was joking at Blue Ridge. I was giving my keynote on building a bridge. I had mentioned that he came up to me and he said, "Hey, I know I'm going to name my first son." And he's like 9. So of course I'm thinking, what?
Right.
And so I said, all right, I'm playing along here. So I'm saying, okay, you're going to name him after me, right? And he goes, no, I'm going to name him Caesar. So I said,
like, oh, man. I love it. Hey, well, you tell him. You that's awesome. I got my start right around the same age. That was when I fell in love with Rome. Now, I didn't know, you know, I was going to end up writing books about it, but I still remember running around in my backyard pretending to be Maximus from Gladiator, you know. So I think it starts there a lot for a lot of us.
I'm fueling one of your future fans here, man. We got him like a Roman sword for his birthday, red cape and everything like that. So you've got a future fan coming up here.
That is
So on that note, Vincent, why don't you tell us about how you go about creating heroes and villains in ancient Rome? And then we'll take that so you can give us an example of one of your favorite characters that you've created, either hero or villain, and what's important for writers to keep in mind when they're writing these types of characters. So let's start with, how do you go about creating heroes and villains in ancient Rome?
That's a great question. So first of all, it's made relatively easy, I think, because of the landscape and the time period, right? Because there is this really defined juxtaposition between the individuals that lived then, at least in our eyes, right? In this, you know, we have a very different moral compass. In some ways, it's not so different, but, you know, obviously we have a Judeo-Christian value system in our society, and they did not, at least at the time period that I'm writing in. But you know, there was such a level of, to be fair, that their culture dealt with many of the things that ours does, right? Greed, hubris, excess, luxury, selfishness, a lack of concern for the greater good or your country, a lack of patriotism, a cynicism about the world. All of these things kind of coalesced at the fall of the Roman Republic. And it just before Julius Caesar. And so, you know, everything was excess and greed. And, you know, it strikes a big resemblance with today. Right. And sure. So what originally, you know, just absolutely fascinated me and drew me to that time, you know, I think it's what, as a young man, you know, when I was, you know, pretty young, and especially when I was in high school, I was fascinated by reading about these Romans who, that was the world in which they lived. But every once in a while, you would find a gem who, you know, just, you know, one or two men that just stood out from that. Mm-hmm. And they displayed all of the things which we would find admirable, you know, restraint, selflessness, sacrifice, duty, right? So I have to say that I'm very fortunate to have some great templates out there. But I think I think one of the first things that I will say in terms of defining my characters, one of the most important things I think we can do is we have to understand the broader landscape of the culture and the people groups at a high level. Because I don't think that we can't make our characters stand out in any meaningful or admirable way if we don't understand and express what everyone else is like, right? So we need to understand the culture. We need to understand the cultural norms. What are the cultural values? Mm-hmm. And then we have to find a meaningful and believable way to reveal why our character is different, why they are, superior in their kind of moral compass or something along those lines. So, I think that's one of the ways that we start, right, is by understanding the culture around them. So for instance, with ancient Rome, right, they had a lot of values that we would deem, admirable, but then a lot of them weren't. Obviously, they maintained slaves, right? They had a large slave culture. So for my character, one of the first, my main character, he is a practicing Stoic. Mm. And Stoics, at least in theory, did not believe in slavery. So that was one thing that immediately he's in this landscape, which he is considered to be kind of odd, even. A little strange that he doesn't believe in the process or the practice of slavery. So I think that's something that makes him attractive, but it was also important that I made it believable too, right? It couldn't just be because he felt bad or whatever, because, you know, that wasn't considered to be an evil practice at that time, believe it or not. Right. It's hard to comprehend it with today's moral compass. So that's one of the things, was understanding very, very clearly the entire culture around which he exists, and then in some ways making him the consummate Roman, and then in other ways making him the juxtaposition, making him the opposite, in ways that we would find more admirable or redeemable than say the general culture.
And I think the point you bring up there is really spot on when we're talking about taking the understanding the culture as a whole, especially in the time that we're living in. One of the things that is, in my view, a little bit frustrating about historical fiction when I come across this in novels is where we have the author taking current modern contemporary norms.
Oh, yes.
Superimposing it over the past. And to me, that defeats the very value of what we're here to do. I mean, if we're dealing with a culture, as you mentioned, a culture that has slavery predominantly around it, well, it's not considered an evil thing at that time. And we need to understand that. That's the value of reading historical fiction. We want to enter the mindset of the people and of the culture and sociopolitical landscape. I like definitely love your approach there about taking a character that's stands apart from this and juxtaposing with the current norms so that way we can have traits that we relate to with this. I've seen it done in ancient Rome by another author. It was actually a very interesting take where the protagonist, very likable, believable character, does maintain slaves, does do different things like that. We are drawn to him though as an individual because of the way he treats them. I think was very unique because, you know, it's very unique because we have kind of like this blanket mentality. Okay, you own slaves and therefore you're going to totally always abuse them. Obviously, I'm not justifying the use of slavery in any way, shape or form.
Sure.
But the point of the matter is that's a misconception. If I were to believe that every Roman was, you know, totally abusive to all their slaves in that aspect, that may not actually always be accurate. So it's really right, neat to capture that aspect of that, even though it might be challenging to our own social norms, as we would say. But it's also relatable given the human trafficking issues that we face in our current society. You understand?
You're absolutely right. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that I think that is so important. And I think that we, you know, historical fiction writers in particular, really, they put themselves in peril, I think, when they try to superimpose our value system on those of another culture. Because, well, first of all, it kind of defeats the purpose of the landscape that we're utilizing in the first place, right? And it's it's rather lazy writing that I think that most readers, you know, and there are a large number of my readers that know as much or maybe even more about Rome than I do and the culture at large. I've had readers send me a message, hey, the armor on the cover image wasn't actually utilized for about another 20 years.
Wow.
You know, which is like, I know, but it's pretty hard to get stock photography of ancient Romans, right? So they're just not readily available. But you know, that some of them are absolutely brilliant. And so they're going to notice those things immediately, right? But even I think the general reader has a certain sense of, you know, hey, whoa, those are probably not things that they would say or believe. And so Sertorius, my main character, you know, in many ways, we today, if he were living today, right, we would find him admirable. But in other ways, we might even find him repulsive to some degree, because, I mean, he is a hardened veteran.
Right.
In one of the most recent battles in the most recent book, they have been faced with a rebellion, right? And so they've traitors have been stirring up problems and caused a major battle. And so he's forced to handle these people afterwards. So, for instance, in our day and age, right, in a time where we're not in a war of this scale, and our lives aren't threatened, our culture is not threatened, those kinds of things, right? Like we would say, you know, be merciful. You know, let them go. But for someone in his position, that's not an option. So the thing that sets him apart is that he is merciful with them, so to speak. He puts them down and gives them an honorable death rather than, say, you know, a crucifixion, which was a typical practice at the time, or a hanging or a stoning, or, you know, so. And he's even remorseful about having to do it. You know, it's not something that he wanted to do. So if I just gave him the same kind of value system I think we had today, I think it would come across as very disingenuous. It's important. Important.
I think that one of the challenges that we face, especially in a very hypersensitive culture as historical authors, is the idea that, and I'm speaking more now writing for the Christian market, in particular, it's very challenging at times, especially when you're dealing in times of war, because I typically tend to write about war dramas around the world wars, First and Second World Wars. And, you know, there was a lot moving on that would be totally at odds with what's accepted in a lot of the
right.
the current sociopolitical climate, and also regards to writing for a Christian audience in that aspect. And so sometimes there are times as an author, you've got to make those really tough calls where you're looking at, showing mercy to an enemy at this point is simply not an option. Because then they will return, and you will have to do it.
Absolutely. Long,
and there's repercussions. And that's just the nature. It's not the people that are evil necessarily, but it's war itself that is evil. And as long as we have that, we've got to deal with this, you know. So it's very challenging. I think that's a great point you bring up. And I think that that's something that we'll have to continue to deal with and evolve with. But your readers, you know, they you've got to give them what they're looking for in that sense. You've got to, but I think more importantly, it's important to be true to the characters of the time. So that way we're doing our job as historical fiction authors. Great point you brought up. Thank you. All right.
Absolutely.
I noticed that on your website, and that you, like me, it seems like you tend to have a strong focus on writing strong male characters. So looking at this here, let's talk about writing male characters, because that's something that I really delve a lot in on a lot of my workshops. And I have a whole series coming up that's geared more definitely towards more male readers. So about this, can you tell us what strategies you use to create male characters that resonate with male and female readers that pick up your books, understanding that probably the majority of your readers, just based on cover design, whatever, might be more male? I don't know.
That's true.
Okay, so then how are you creating strategies that resonate with male characters? Let's focus on that over here first.
So first of all, I will say that this is something that I think you and I both are very, very passionate about. I am very, very passionate about writing strong male characters. Not strong in a traditional sense of just like physical or political strength or anything like that, but really, really good characters, right? Because I think it's part of the reason that I resonated so much with Rome from a historical perspective, because our young men today are left so much without a moral compass, right? They're caught in this, the middle of just you know, they're kind of are forgotten right now in that they're told in some ways that, you know, to be a strong, you know, masculine male is to be, you know, some offensive or to be part of a, you know, an ancient problem that has kind of been a problem for society, you know? So it's difficult, right? So it's really difficult to find that. So in Rome, I found practical examples. Now, of course I had, you know, scripture and I have my faith, but at this time they didn't, you know, they didn't really have anything like that. So I just found these examples of these men who were at the exact same time period where, you know, where to even discuss something such as honor would have almost been kind of looked at with like, kind of like a smile, you know, just kind of like, really, you know, those old archaic notions of right and wrong, you know, this is a cynical time in the late Republic where anything goes really, you know, one of the questions in book one that one of the politicians asked Sertorius is it better to be a good man and accomplish nothing or to be a bad man but accomplish great things? And so that's the world that he's faced with of like, if I want to do anything good, I have to break the rules. I have to, you know, I have to get looser with my morals. But ultimately, you know, he resists that. And so I find that so, so important that these characters, I think, can be inspiring without being lecturing, right, of remaining strong or remaining focused on your moral code, regardless of the implications, regardless of what the world is doing around you. And so that, I think that was really important too. But the male characters, I tell you, I mean, it is difficult because, you absolutely hit the nail on the head at this time. I think, I think for a long time, it was female characters that had, there were so many tropes around female characters. And right. So I don't think that they were well written very often. You know, the matronly, perfect, moralistic woman who was so far on a pedestal that she wasn't a very good character. Or there's like the conniving, like, you know, kind of behind the scenes, spreading rumors, causing trouble, you know, that one, right? So, and there's like these tropes. And so they weren't creating very good characters. And now I feel like female characters have a lot more nuance, or at least that's what I've seen in a lot of fiction here lately. And now I feel like it's been the male characters that have kind of been moving over to that. There's these tropes of like, you know, the meathead who's, you know, just the bully, right? Or then there's, you know, so I don't know. There's a whole lot we could get into. But I think getting back to the basics of character design and giving nuance, I think, is one of the most important things that we can do. And I think Stephen James, who is you know, a writing coach and author, and I've learned so much from him. He talks a lot about the concept of status, mm-hmm. and having your characters have different statuses. So, for instance, he has, you know, he writes thrillers, you know, crime thrillers. And, you know, so when his detective is on the crime scene, like he is at the peak of his status, he's running the show, like that's his arena. So he speaks to people from a position of authority, no matter who it is. But then he goes back home and he sees a pretty woman, or he sees, you know, there's the, you know, an elderly neighbor who looks after him and takes care of him because he's, you know, whatever. Then maybe he like stumbles on his words a little bit, or he's kind of more, he's at a lower status in addressing them. That's layered, that's nuanced. And I think that keeps your characters from being well-rounded, because I think the characters, the male characters that I see that often do not resonate are the male characters that do not show one of those two statuses enough. They either are always too high status, right? They're always, you know, the hero, right? They are always, he's just exuding strength and courage and virtue, and they rarely do anything wrong. They're rarely in a position of weakness in any way. Or on the other hand, I think we can be inclined to write some male characters as very low status, where they are, you know, perhaps always in a position of weakness, or, you know, but, you know, lower than others. Right. And so I think the biggest flaw that we can make is to have them be too high all the time, or to be too low all the time. Right. It's about showing that nuance, which it gives layers. It makes those times, right, when he's, you know, maybe stammering, talking to a pretty girl, it makes him a lot more interesting when he's in that position of power, you know, as a commander or something like that. Or, absolutely, you know, if he's in a low position of power, politically or militarily, it makes him a lot more interesting when he's, you know, playing a game of dice with his friends and he's one calling all the shots and everybody's looking up to him or something along those lines, you know? So it just adds a lot more, depth to a character just to make that simple change.
Quite honestly, I mean, what you're describing is really real life. You know, all of us, you know, as men, whether we're in a position of authority or not, in life, there are moments, and there are atmospheres and times where we are in a certain scenario and we've got everything under control. But then there are scenarios where we might face where we're out of our element. You know, we're feeling, yeah, it might just be that moment here where you're going on the road and someone unexpected walks your way or something like that happens and you're taken off guard, or like you said, the pretty girl situation or whatever else like that. And it's really important to, I think, to just to flesh these guys out. But most importantly, I think for myself, as I'm looking at, as you mentioned very well there, that we have a generation of men, especially younger readers, younger boys that are growing up into manhood, that really don't have an idea as to what masculinity is really all about and why, right, they should be proud to be men and do these things and take these responsibilities and so forth seriously. My hope is that in creating strong male characters that are relatable, understandable, but also have that strong moral compass, like you were mentioning with your main character, your protagonist here, my hope is that we can actually set examples and influence their own philosophies as to what is their own personal creed of manhood and how should we be in morals and honor and things like that as well, as we're going through that. Because one of the things I experience a lot in my work, and this is outside my work as an author, I have a whole other life. I'm not on the side of author.
Right. We usually do.
Yeah. And I get involved a lot with teens and youth and things like that. And one of the things that I'm seeing growing up is that, especially in areas where, yeah, boys growing up without a father figure in their lives, they're kind of left floundering. You know, they're kind of left just to figure life out on their own. And mom can't do it all. She might be hardworking. She might be whatever else. But if mom is there, I'm saying that too. It's really difficult to actually give a true picture, if not impossible, to give a true picture of what manhood and masculinity is supposed to be like without a father figure there. So yet books, you know, if we can create characters that will actually encourage these young men to read, that they're saying, man, I can't wait for Vincent's next book. You know, I just love the way he's got that guy portrayed there. And they're drawn maybe not even so much to the story, but they're drawn to the main character. And that character is setting a good example for them. You know, we're actually achieving something beneficial in our society beyond just sales and beyond these things. We're actually changing a life.
Right.
And that, I think, is what this is all about, really, as authors. That's why we spend hours bleeding all over the keyboard. we want to make that difference. So that sounds great. All right. And we're about to wrap up here today. But just before we do, I would ask you, is there anything that you would think, if you can crystallize for me, one thing that authors should not do when creating male characters? I'm sure we alluded to some and talking what they should do, but is there anything they definitively should not do, or you really think they should stay away from when creating male characters, that because a large amount of our listeners are probably female authors that are creating male characters and want to make sure that they're being impactful and effective. What would be one thing that you would say be very careful and avoid doing at all costs if you can?
So I alluded to one before. I think having the perfect male, let's say, I think would not be a good thing to do in publishing. Not just because it would be offensive to the sensibilities of those who are offended by masculinity, but because it doesn't make for great character design, right? Because all of us are you know, nuanced, and we have our flaws, and we have things that set us apart from maybe like the ideal, the perfect version of a male, so I think that can be one of the biggest things to make a character a little bit I don't know if unlikable is the right word, but it's we can't connect or we can't see ourselves in perfection.
Right.
And I think the worst thing that we could do we already have a limited number of young men that are reading, right? Like, I think that number is actually probably growing rather than decreasing is what we're hearing a lot, which is really encouraging. But I think the worst thing that could happen for a young man who's reading is to immediately recognize that he's being preached to this is the way that you should be, right? Some form of agenda of kind of overarching, this is what, we want to teach you. It should almost be on a subliminal level, right? Like, our goal is always to tell a good story first, a really, really good story. So Lord of the Rings, for example, I'm actually rereading that now for the first time in many years and loving every second of it. So there's nothing within the Lord of the Rings that is inherently telling me that this is the way that I should be, right? That it's not preaching at me. It's Tolkien just created this amazing world and wrote this amazing story. And then from that, I find myself inspired to be courageous, right? Yeah. Like Aragorn, or to be like this, to be loyal unto almost a fault to, those that I love, and to take care of them and carry them like Sam did, right? So I'm encouraged by what I'm reading. So I still remember speaking with a very, very successful author early on in my career and asking, to what degree is it important for me as a Christian to put my Christian values within my books? And I think you could probably apply that to anything that we believe, right? Like, how important is it that I, have my value system front and center, or how important is it that I do this or do that? And he said that, if you're a doctor, you're not only going to treat Christian patients, generally speaking, you're not going to have, a sign at the door that says no one welcome here unless you're saved and, part of this church or something. Right. So that your job is as a Christian doctor is just simply to be the absolute best doctor that you can possibly be. And when that is seen, then you give the glory to God. So that is kind of been my creed as I've been writing is, I don't write for a Christian audience because my books actually take place immediately before Christ, right? Sure. About 100 years. But I'm writing from a Christian worldview, of course, but my goal is to tell the absolute best story that I can. So I've researched the craft and I've researched character development so my goal is to write the best character that I possibly can, write the best book that I possibly can. And then I think that those other elements, some of them take care of themselves. I rather than trying to starting with a premise of like, I need to fix the world, so to speak, the world is filled with problems and books can help solve many of them. But I think that we actually handicap ourselves a little bit when we start with the agenda and then move to story and character later. I think that we start with writing the best story we can. And then I think that most writers will find that once we start there, that the lessons and the themes and the encouragement, they come out of that very naturally when we have those characters that are well-defined and a story that's well-written.
I think that's a really really thought-provoking and insightful answer, and thank you very much for that. It's really, just listening to there, my mind, as you mentioned, Lord of the Rings and so forth there, my mind goes back to the thing that stays with me from that whole series is the depth of thought and analysis of human nature, I think, that comes out of it.
Yeah.
It's something that at the end of that book, or even the initial, I'm not going to talk about the new one, okay? I'm not going to say anything about it.
No.
The initial one. Looking, right. Yeah. But looking back at that, I think what comes out of it is the thought that I can sit down after, you know, watching 6 hours or whatever it was, or reading that book and say, you know what, I have a better understanding of human beings, and I have a better understanding of myself and how I can serve or work or grow. And I think that when we apply that to your writing, my writing, you know, as writers, we apply that idea that, you know what, let's just create such a powerful, awesome story. So people at the end of it can look back and say, you know what, I'm a better person for having read this, or I've learned something or thought of something in a different way. I think we've really done our job in it as well. So that was very well said. Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for your time today. Again, listening audience, this is Vincent Davis. You can connect with him online at his website, vincentbdavisii.com. And I believe, Vincent, you also have a book marketing website. Is that correct?
That is true. Yeah, warriorbookmarketing.com. Okay. That's where I connect with authors to run their marketing for Amazon. I like to do coaching and teach people how to do it. So all of the above.
Awesome. And those links will be available on this post and on my website. Links will be linked over to that as well, to those two. So you can connect with Vincent directly through there as well. All right. Well, thank you so much again for joining us today, Vincent, and everyone listening in. And we pray everyone has a wonderful day.